You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Bill Campbell might be the most important football coach you've never heard of. He spent a dozen years of his life coaching the Boston College Eagles and the Columbia Lions through one disappointing season after another. He never won a bowl championship, and he's not enshrined alongside Bobby Bowden and Bear Bryant in the College Football Hall of Fame. But after retiring from football, he took the lessons he learned on the field and moved to Silicon Valley, where he achieved a stunning track record of success as a different kind of coach, playing an instrumental role in the growth of companies such as Intuit, Google, and Apple, and mentoring many of the tech industry's greatest visionaries, including Jeff Bezos, Mark Andreessen, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, Sheryl Sandberg, Steve Jobs, and Eric Schmidt. Eric Schmidt met with Bill Campbell every week for 15 years while he was chairman and CEO of Google and then executive chairman of Google's parent company, Alphabet. And now he's distilled some of Campbell's most important lessons into a new book titled Trillion Dollar Coach, The Leadership Playbook of Silicon Valley's Bill Campbell. And on today's podcast, Eric reveals how he initially reacted when venture capitalist John Doerr told the newly minted CEO that he needed a coach, how Coach Campbell helped shape the relationship between Eric and Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page, why Campbell initially refused Eric's invitation to join Google's board of directors, and how he talked Eric out of resigning as Google's CEO way back in 2004. Eric says Campbell wasn't just another executive coach, he coached the whole team, and discusses the importance of trust and even love to a team's success, and ultimately the company's bottom line. He shares some of Campbell's secrets for handling difficult personalities, or the aberrant genius, as he liked to call them, and shed some light on Campbell's longtime friendship with one of those aberrant geniuses, Apple's Steve Jobs. Then, Eric opens up about his decision to step down as chairman of Alphabet in 2017 and his next big bet on the positive potential of artificial intelligence. Plus, why starting off a meeting with a little polite chit-chat isn't a waste of time, and the power of hugs in the workplace. Coming up with Eric Schmidt in just a moment. Eric Schmidt served as Google CEO and chairman from 2001 until 2011, Google executive chairman from 2011 to 2015, and then as executive chairman at Google's newly formed parent company Alphabet from 2015 to 2018. Now he's reteamed with Google's senior VP Jonathan Rosenberg and Google director of communications Alan Eagle to write a book about the man without whom he says Google wouldn't be the company it is today. The book is called Trillion Dollar Coach, The Leadership Playbook of Silicon Valley's Bill Campbell. Eric, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you very much, Ben. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, Eric, Bill Campbell may very well be the most influential person in Silicon Valley that people outside the Valley have never heard of. Who are some of the people and companies that he coached to success?
Well, it's interesting that Bill hated the press and he hated the spotlight, and he would probably hate the idea of this book, which we think captures the secrets of his coaching, which we think is a new idea, an idea of business coaching for teams, right? People never do this.
Right.
And Bill was both the mentor as well as the coach for Steve Jobs and Apple during its meteoric rise from the early 90s to now. He was also my coach and Larry and Sergey's coach during the incredible success of Google, along with many, many other companies, including LinkedIn, Intuit, and others.
That's a hell of a track record, so I guess the name Trillion Dollar Coach is well-deserved.
Well, we would argue, let's be clear, he's the most successful coach in history, right?
Wow.
He's created a couple $1 trillion of economic value. That's extraordinary.
Well, Eric, as I'm sure you know, there's no shortage of people these days who bill themselves as life coaches or executive coaches, to the point that it's almost become a joke. But Bill Campbell clearly delivered the goods, and he was a bona fide coach. In fact, he had literally been a college football coach for 12 years, right?
Well, indeed, we called him Coach because he really had the demeanor and behavior of a football coach. He also had the curse words and the roughness of such a person, but he had a keen insight in how to get people to play on a team. It's interesting that you mentioned life coaches and executive coaches, and I'm sure they're very valuable, but they're not coaching the entity that matters, which is the whole team.
Mm-hmm.
So we're arguing that the whole team matters, and Bill built and pioneered the notion of not just coaching Steve Jobs, but all the people who worked for him. And not just myself, but all the people who worked around us, including the board, I might add.
So how did Bill Campbell go from coaching football players to coaching tech execs? What brought him to Silicon Valley?
He was he had been a football coach, and then he was at J. Walter Thompson and Kodak, and then joined Apple as the vice president of marketing. He did the original Apple 1984 Super Bowl ad that everybody's so excited about. Brilliant, brilliant marketeer. So coach to marketeer, and then when Apple got in trouble and Steve came back for the second time, he became the first board member of Apple.
Did Bill Campbell wear his experience as a college football coach on his sleeve? For instance, when he coached you, did he speak in football metaphors and that sort of thing?
No, I guess maybe he had that in him years earlier, but by the time he showed up with us, he was basically motivating people.
Okay.
It's interesting that we, in the course of the writing the book, we've spoken to people who were who he coached as actual football players, and they said that he didn't win very many games, but he was an extraordinary motivator of humans, and indeed he would cry, you know, in the locker room about a loss or whatever. He was incredibly emotionally connected to his players.
You met with him almost every week for 15 years, starting right around the time that you became Google's CEO. How did you react when someone suggested, as a new CEO at Google, that you needed to work with an executive coach?
Well, I thought it was the stupidest idea ever. I mean, after all, here I am. I'm a very successful executive. I know everything. I've done everything conceivable, especially compared to the young people that I'm working with. I'm so much more experienced than them. And my friend John Doerr, who was proposing this, said, look, he's a good guy. And I knew him socially. He was certainly a good guy, Bill Campbell. And then John said, and I was arguing. I said, look, it's not necessary. I don't have time. And John said, do tennis players have coaches? And I said, well, of course they do. And I pointed out that the coaches weren't as good as the tennis players by definition, because if the coaches were better than the tennis players, they'd be playing the sport rather than coaching. And then John said, it's a different skill, Eric. The Campbell skill, the Bill Campbell skill, is a different skill than the one you are developing. He will help you get better. And I thought, well, I can't resist that argument. And at the moment Bill and I sat down, it was clear to me that this would be a great relationship. Eventually what happened over time, he had worked on various board issues and various people issues. Eventually he became so important that we had him come to our staff meeting. He came to all the board meetings, and he was integral in every decision the company made.
Bill had a particular affinity for founders and certain ideas about how founders and CEOs should work together. How did that shape your own relationship with Google's founders, Larry Page and Sergey Brin?
I think it had a huge impression on me. Bill's view, which is also my view, is that the founders are very special. They need to be treated with great respect. Both he and I believe that founders deserve the respect for founding the company and also the respect for getting their judgment right, especially on hard issues. Mm-hmm. There are lots of people who disagree with that. They think that somehow you should bring in professional management and so forth. But we believe, and in particular Bill believed, that it's better to work with the strengths and weaknesses of the founders because there's something special about them. And everything we did was around that. So in particular with Larry and Sergey, they had enormous strengths. And if there were things they didn't want to do or weren't particularly experienced in, I would do those. Mm-hmm. No problem.
You credit Bill as one of the people most responsible for Google's success. And you also say that he's the reason you didn't resign from Google when the board asked you to step down as chairman and remain as CEO in 2004 ahead of the IPO. How did he convince you to stay on through that period?
Well, of course, this was a long time ago, but I think it illustrates the trust. Mm-hmm. There was a complicated transaction involving board governance, and it was agreed that I would remain as CEO, but I shouldn't be chairman. And this hurt my feelings. This was literally just vanity and pride on my part. And I was so upset, I called up Bill and said, I'm quitting. This is stupid, right? This is the wrong thing. And Bill said, listened to me for a while and said, I really think this is a terrible mistake. And so we chatted the next day and he said, look, I think this is a mistake and I agree with your arguments. You're doing a fine job. I'll fix it. And that was the thing I needed to hear to calm down enough to say, okay. Now, he didn't say when he said fix it what he was going to do. He didn't say I'm going to call this person or I'm going to file this complaint or I'm going to hire this person or what have you. He just said, I'll fix it. So here's a case where the trust mattered a lot. Had he not been there, I might have done something really, really stupid and not in my own self-interest. And it was my ego, my pride, my vanity. So what I like about that story is, first, he saved me. Right? None of this other stuff would have happened had I done something so stupid. But it's a good illustration of how somebody who's in a fantastic situation, in my case, could have such poor judgment in this moment. That the rest is history.
Yeah.
And we have other stories in the book of other situations where somebody got upset or kind of out of line. This is the case where I got out of line. And he figured out a way to reel them in. And here's how he did it. His basic goal was to fight for the team. If you were part of the team and the stuff that you were doing was consistent with the team, he wanted you on the team and he wanted you focused on the team. And if you were dealing in your own, whether it's arrogance or self-pity or what have you, such as in my case, he would figure out a way to get you back onto the team.
Silicon Valley is full of brilliant but difficult and sometimes egotistical personalities, or what Bill Campbell would call the aberrant genius. How did he manage them?
What's interesting is, do you think that that's also true of football teams? Of course
sure.
It is, right? It's also true of basketball teams. It's true of people in the media industry and so forth. Many of these industries have these sort of high skills, high ego kind of people, and they require a special skill. And that skill is to listen to them and to help shape where they're going. They don't respond well to being yelled at least not directly. And they care and they have a pride for what they do. Bill's coaching mechanism was to figure out what the person cared about, make sure they thought that he thought they were really good at it. And then as they got better and made mistakes, he would help tune them. Hey, you did a great job there, but you could have done this other thing better. And the person says, yeah, you know, maybe that's right. Mm-hmm. And then they self-program to be better.
There's no better example than his friendship and mentorship of Steve Jobs. Campbell was one of the few people who stood up for Jobs when he was pushed out at Apple. And the two of them took these long walks and had deep conversations just about every day. And Campbell visited Steve Jobs in the hospital constantly toward the end. What was that relationship like, and what do you think they saw in each other?
It was about as close as two humans can be. Steve was a difficult person. He was often loud, often pushing, and so forth, but totally brilliant. We miss him terribly. Enormous respect from people who dealt with Steve. And during the beginning of Steve's illness through his death, Bill was pretty much at his side, along with his wife and family. And so for all the critical decisions, initial hospitalization, the eventual transplant, and so forth, Bill was his sort of advisor. What's more important is at the same time, Bill was also coaching, in the same manner I'm describing, all the Apple executives. So his relationship with Steve, which is highly intimate in the sense of his medical situation and so forth, also allowed him to understand what Steve wanted and help keep the company together during an enormously difficult time.
Bill Campbell served on the board of directors of Apple as well as Google, but I guess he really didn't like being on corporate boards. Why not? Did he see the roles of coach and board member as somehow being at odds?
Well, what's interesting was he refused to get on our board.
Oh, really?
He also refused any compensation. When I met him, which was in roughly 2000, he said he'd made enough money. He didn't want any compensation. You got to be kidding. And he said, no, I'm giving back. And I said, well, don't you want to be on the board? And he said, if I were on your board, it would prevent me from doing what I want to do.
Really?
He saw himself as a coach of the board, a coach of me, and a coach of the management team. He didn't want to be conflicted to be any one of us. He wanted to work with all of us equally.
I believe you did finally convince him to join Google's board of directors. What was he like in a board meeting?
What's interesting about Bill is that he very seldom said anything in group settings. So he would observe. And every once in a while, when the sort of energy in the room would go out, he would do what we now know was his signature, which is he would do a percussive clap, 5 claps. And the idea of this was to sort of shock everyone to smiling and get the energy in the room up. And, you know, it seems bizarre, but here you are in a corporate board meeting. It's all very serious. And then this guy's clapping. He knew how to get people excited and motivated. In private, however, he was very verbal, very aggressive with what you needed to do. So he would talk to the board members ahead of time and give them a heads up and give me a heads up and so forth. And in the board, he would observe.
I think that you say that he had a very direct manner in one-on-one meetings, and I think one of his mottos was, I don't take cash, I don't take stock, and I don't take bullshit.
That's correct. And indeed, one of the things that's interesting about him is he was very, very sensitive to people who would mislead him. So if he thought that you were not telling him the full truth, he was very rough on you.
Really?
You had to be straight with him. You had to be honest with him. And in return, he was honest back. And the reason people were willing to do this, which is sort of interesting and, again, counterfactual, is that when he would meet people, he wouldn't ask them, what do they do? Like, you know, when I meet you, Ben, I'd say, well, what do you do? Well, I do a highly rated, you know, blog or what have you. You know, he wouldn't say that. He'd say, Ben, tell me about who you are. What's your family like? Where do you live? What are you worried about? And he would build trust. And then at some point he'd say, oh, yeah, tell me about your show. Tell me about your work. And then at some point he'd come back and say, you're the best in the world at what you do. And then after that he'd find some failing and say, you didn't do that as well as you could. Notice the coaching?
Yeah, he builds, interesting.
This is the algorithm. He builds trust. He works with you. He becomes a friend, at least a professional friend, in some cases an even closer friend. Then he sort of builds you up. You know, you're the best quarterback ever, except that you missed the last 7 passes. What's wrong? And then he would find a way to sort of ingratiate you, but then also to improve you. The key thing about coaching that I did not understand until now is that coaching is about coaching you to be your best and to believe in yourself, as opposed to managing, which is what are we doing, who are we doing, who's doing what.
Mm-hmm.
Different skills.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Eric Schmidt when we come back in just a minute. And I was really interested in the way he would open these meetings by asking about your family, talking about his own, maybe asking about your weekend or a recent trip that you took. Nobody does that.
Yeah, and who does that, right? I mean, who does that? I mean, I can't imagine in California, in New York, what are we doing? Talking about your kids? I mean,
right.
Let's get back to work, right? But
yeah.
His approach was different.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm not alone in being one of those people who, you know, the thing that I hate about meetings often is the obligatory niceties and chit-chat before you get down to business. But for him, it sounds like it was more than just chit-chat. What did that accomplish in his mind?
You know, it's funny that you and I have the same sort of view, and maybe many of your listeners as well, of let's dispense with all, let's get back to the really important stuff. But what Bill taught was the most important stuff was the people. And by the way, every company I know of, they say the most important thing we have is the people. Well, if it's the most important thing, then why don't you work on the people, right? Rather than the other problems.
True.
And so these little, what I call stupid stuff, you know, the high-fiving and the greeting and how are you and all that kind of stuff, you know, turns out to be central to building a team.
And I think that you say one of the ways that you're able to get the people who don't usually speak up to speak up was that tool of starting off a meeting by asking about what they did last weekend or a trip that they went on or the family. Once they speak up about that, they feel more comfortable speaking up about business. Huh?
It's exactly, you got it exactly right. What's funny is that people in high-stakes businesses are often kind of a little bit either politicized or they're afraid to speak up or something. They're worried about something happening. So starting with an icebreaker in the sense of, here we are, we're having a nice chat. How was everybody's week? Where did you go? It was both a way of getting signals intelligence, mm-hmm. you know, what was going on in Germany or what was going on in Florida or what have you. But it also got people to talk. And eventually it evolved to people saying, I didn't travel, but I went to this party on Saturday night and I talked to Joe Schmo. And Joe Schmo is readying a competitor that will come in and work against one of our product lines. Anybody want to do something about that? So it became a way of getting information into the system that would not have, you know, would not have otherwise gotten into the company. You as a business executive are only as successful as the team around you. You depend on that team's success. You need to work with them.
Well, Eric, I'd like to go back to this idea of the coach of teams as opposed to the typical executive coach. That strikes me as particularly significant because executives come and go, and Bill could spend his time coaching one CEO who then might leave the company just a year later. Where's the value in that, you know? But if he's coaching the company, he's creating a culture that persists regardless of executive turnover, trends, downturns, and all of the ephemeral stuff.
And in fact, what the argument we're making in the book, which we're trying to popularize, is that the coach of teams idea is one that's never discussed, and yet it's the most important one. Imagine a football team without a coach. How well would they do? Can you think of any sport that doesn't have coaches? What, do they just self-assemble and run up and down the you know, the court or what have you?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And yet in business, we naturally adopt these structures without any kind of coaching. We have minimal management training. One of the other arguments that we've come to after writing the book is that there's not going to be enough coaches in the world, and it's going to be important to have people who think that they are managers also learn coaching mm-hmm. skills.
It also sounds like there was a force multiplying effect to his method because he was teaching managers to become better coaches themselves, and in a way that would ripple down the chain of command from the CEO to the VPs all the way down to the managers.
I'll give you another example.
Okay.
Here in New York, one of the executives, we did an employee event. She described the following. She had done a great thing about earnings and she was very proud of herself. And Bill ran in and said, had a meeting with her. And Bill said, I don't want to meet with you. I want to meet with the people who did such a good job that they made you look good. So they assembled all these young people who must have been in their 20s. And he thanked every one of them, told them they were great, made a huge difference. This took a total of 5 minutes. Then he sat down with her and had a proper meeting. Now, what's the value of that 5 minutes? Every single person remembers that 5 minutes for the next 5 years.
Wow.
What's the value in terms of motivation of these young people, some of whom will ultimately become vice presidents and eventually the CEO perhaps? Enormous developmentally. It's a simple rule. Take a moment to look around, try to figure who did the work, talk to them directly, say that they were superstars, and they will remember it far more than you'll ever remember that you chatted with them. It's part of motivating humans.
Yeah, and one thing that he used to say was, work the team, not the problem. Can you explain what he meant by that?
He had a core idea that it was more important to work on people than the problem. Because if you got the right people, then the problem would be resolved. It's a simple mm-hmm. idea. So what normally happens is everybody sits around and they say, well, we have a problem. You know, we have this regulation problem or this business problem, or this customer problem or competitor problem. He would say, let's not do that. Who are the smartest people to tell us what to do here? Let's assemble that subgroup and have them come back after due deliberation and make a thoughtful response. So you see, even in the case where there's a business problem, he would say people first, not business problem first. In all businesses I know, it's the inverse. They debate the business problem forever.
Right.
Rather than saying, don't we have some people here who really understand this stuff, who can come back with a sort of something for us to debate and decide about?
And when it came to decision-making, apparently Bill did not like the word consensus.
No.
He believed in what you call the throne behind the round table. How does that work? Is that like the first among equals or what?
He articulated it in the following way. Most companies get to some kind of consensus, but that's not your objective. Your objective is to get to the best idea. So we had an algorithm, and the algorithm was to let the people who talk all the time talk. And then he said, call on the people you never hear from and make sure you hear from them. Often their ideas are better than the people who talk all the time. And then drive it to a process where there's a pretty clear best idea. If you cannot get to a best idea, then figure out why you can't. Try not to go to a consensus decision or the loud people's decision or your own decision. This works.
Let me ask you this. What do you do about things within an organization that undermine teams, like office politics and competing interests? When you have colleagues trying to undercut or one-up each other, campaigning for the boss's favor or vying for promotions, don't those things undermine the team? How do you handle that?
I don't know about you, but in all my previous work, I've been in executive situations where executives fight over resources and so forth. So we developed a technique where if people were, especially if they disagreed, we would give two people a hard problem and make them work it out themselves. This built trust.
Interesting.
We got to the point at Google, it was bizarre. I mean, it was unheard of, where people would actually call me up and say, well, we've talked about it, and I think actually he or she will do a better job of managing this. I'm going to give them 1,000 people and all the budget, and I'm going to become more dependent on them. I think that's better for the company. And I go like, really? And of course, as the CEO, you say yes. But you see the point, the trust building, the little stuff, whether it's the kids or the family, which is not so little to the individual, of course, which seems incidental or accidental, is in fact central to the principle of managing a corporation.
Trust comes up a lot in this book, and you say it was Bill Campbell's secret weapon. Part of his brilliance was his ability to build trust, which stemmed from the character of the man himself and his own personal trustworthiness.
Yeah. And are you a trustworthy person? Well, I think a lot depends on how people perceive you in terms of empathy and trust. Can they trust you with their own secrets? And by the way, everybody's got problems. Everybody's got secrets that they're upset about, or they've got some family crisis or what have you. If you can get to the point where people are confiding in you and really trusting you with things that are important to them, then you have a kind of intimacy of communication where you can work together to make things better. It's analogous to the trust that you have with your medical doctor, right? Clearly, as you disclose whatever it is, your ailment, you build trust with the doctor, and then together you can help solve that problem. It's the same principle.
In addition to trust, another word that comes up over and over again with Bill Campbell is a word that you don't hear very often in a business setting. That's love.
Exactly.
What was his idea of love in this context, and why is it so important to a company's success?
When we interviewed everybody in all these different companies, and we quote them extensively, almost all of them use the word love in some context. And when they use the word love, they don't mean it in any other context than brotherly love. Mm-hmm. They meet it in a context of chaste and appropriate friendship and caring about people, and not in any other context. And Bill was the master of that. Bill was, when he would walk in, he would hug everyone, right? Everyone felt that Bill appreciated them. He would say, how's your kid? How's your family? How's your wife? How's your husband? If somebody got sick, he would make a special point of visiting them. This obviously includes Steve Jobs, who was very ill for much of the time Bill worked with him, but also other people. And I remember him telling me about one particular fellow who'd been sick for a very long time. And every week he would go visit his friend who was quite ill. But more importantly, he would go there to support the wife and kids, right, who were going through hell.
Oh, really?
So it's that kind of love, however you want to define it, we can never seem to acknowledge it in business. And yet it's the thing that binds people together.
And as someone who was such a big believer in love in the workplace, and you say that he wasn't a handshaker, he was a hugger, including one very awkward hug with Bill Gates at one point, I wonder, how would he feel about the current mindset in the workplace in the wake of Me Too, where a lot of companies are probably feeling the pressure to avoid any kind of physical touching or any warmth or familiarity that might be misconstrued? How do you think he would handle that? Do you think he might even be a little bit sad about that?
That might be true. I don't think we really know. What I do think is that the next generation of coaches like Bill Campbell won't be hugging everybody for reasons that are kind of obvious. But in any case, the point here is whether you're a hugger or not, I'm the on the non-hugger side of this, you can express your caring for the people you work with in human terms that are both appropriate and respectful and really powerful. And Bill knew how to do that.
There was also apparently a flip side to Bill Campbell as the hugger. You say his approach to people can be defined as hugs and curses. He could be a little bit salty, huh?
Yeah, and my guess is that there would be less of that, too.
Oh, really?
In a future Bill Campbell. But he could be quite colorful and use an awful lot of words that we can't say even on your podcast.
Yeah, well, that's the football coach, though, huh? Was he the kind of guy who would give personal advice to and give you tips about life or family?
He did, and he was very family-focused and went on and on about the values of family and ethics and so forth. What was interesting, though, was that he was he lived his life on these principles. So it was as if he didn't have to give you the advice. He just had to exemplify goodness.
Huh.
So he believed in strong values. So a whole bunch of politicians, for example, he didn't like because he thought that they were manipulative. So he said, if I met with one, he'd say, oh, that's a waste of time. So again, he was very consistent in his worldview and values.
And Bill Campbell coached you through just about every major event in your history at Google, and he was especially good at smoothing out transitions, like when you decided to stay on as CEO and step down as chairman for a brief period, and making you feel that whatever happened next was going to be the right move, not just for the company, but for you as well. Unfortunately, he died of cancer in 2016, so he wasn't around for your last big transition when you stepped down as executive chairman of Alphabet. At such a pivotal moment in your life, did you miss having his friendship and guidance?
I really did. And we worked it out. It was no problem, and it was what everybody wanted. But it felt awkward compared to when Bill was there. Mm-hmm. When Bill was there, Bill would have run around and chatted with everybody and said, you know, what do you guys think? And I think this is a good idea. And how do you feel about it? And so forth. There was no one to do that. Now, again, we got through it in a straightforward way. The difference was in the emotional satisfaction of all of the players that the right thing had occurred.
Mm-hmm. And now that you've left Alphabet, do you see yourself following in Bill's footsteps, writing books like this and coaching teams? What's the next step for you?
I'm very interested in the application of artificial intelligence to science and other things that where we can make a material improvement to the world. I'm also very interested in proposing that this notion of coaching and be combined with leadership. So I'm going to be working on both problems now. And this book is a debut of that activity for me. We have lots of ideas of how to spread this message, but I think your viewers can start by practicing it. See if your management teams and your business and so forth really are better and more fun. Do people work better together using these techniques?
Mm-hmm.
I should say we've also open sourced, in addition to the book, which you can purchase, of course, we've open sourced these techniques in a slideshare called Trillion Dollar Coach, which has the key techniques. So we're really trying to popularize these ideas.
Going back to your interest in AI, are you an AI pessimist like Elon Musk and Bill Gates, or are you an AI optimist?
I'm pretty much an optimist on this. I think that the implementation of these techniques is going to revolutionize many things, in particular healthcare. And if you look at the healthcare problems, much of the observational errors and so forth are better off done with an AI that then makes a recommendation to a doctor.
Well, I know that you have to go, Eric. Before we wrap up here, you have a list of the top 10 Billisms in the book. What's your favorite?
I never ranked them. I just lived them.
Uh-huh.
I think the most important one is the one of I don't take cash that you repeated.
Okay. So Eric Schmidt doesn't take cash either?
No, that's right.
Okay. How about stock options?
Same argument.
Okay. Well, once again, the book is called Trillion Dollar Coach, The Leadership Playbook of Silicon Valley's Bill Campbell. Eric Schmidt, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks again to Eric Schmidt for coming on the podcast. You can order his book, Trillion Dollar Coach, The Leadership Playbook of Silicon Valley's Bill Campbell, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.